Hey, folks, I know there are lots of business owners who listen to this show. Maybe some of you never planned on running a business, but now here you are. One thing you've always got to keep in mind is how much you're spending on your operating costs. That's one of the first things we had to keep in mind with WTF. And with things costing more today than they did when we started, you want to keep your expenses down. To reduce costs and headaches, be smart and use NetSuite by Oracle, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth. Reduce IT costs, cut the costs of maintaining multiple systems, improve efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. By popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/WTF for more. That's NetSuite, NetSuite.com/WTF.
Lock the gate!
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck buddies, what the fuck nicks, what's happening? I'm Mark Maron. This is my podcast, WTF. Welcome to it. Today on the show is a comedian, Zainab Johnson. I didn't know her, and I just started seeing her at the Comedy Store, and I'm like, there's an entire generation of comics I don't know. She's funny. She's a powerful presence. She's on the Prime Video series Upload, which is created by Greg Daniels, and she'll be performing on my gala in Montreal this Saturday. And so I'll see her. That's day after tomorrow. But I just started seeing her on the Comedy Store, and I'm like, you know, I have to talk to this person. I would like to know more about this person. So I guess I talked to you. Like, these shows were done a little bit in advance, because we had to get the week in the can. I was very busy the day I recorded this, and I had a lot to do for the week because we had to pre-record some stuff. But I get obsessed with little things, and some of you know that. It's how I keep my fucking life together. It's my spirituality, a certain OCD around small corrections, you know. And I had bought a watermelon that was, you know, not great. It was bad in just enough of a way that every bite I would take, it would annoy me that I didn't get a better watermelon, or that I didn't throw it away. You know, half of it had a slightly tougher texture than it should be, and it was sweet enough and juicy enough, but half of it was too mushy and the other half was too stiff. I don't know how to explain it. You don't know what you're going to get, but it sounded correct. When I held it to my head and I knocked on the outside, I got the tone I wanted, and I think theoretically it wasn't my mistake. It was an illusion. Nonetheless, it was sitting in my fridge and I'm in the middle of a busy day and I'm like, fuck it. I got to make this right. I got to go find a watermelon I enjoy. I don't want to, because I enjoy watermelon. I'm on this sugar detox still, and it's the only fruit I can eat, that and blueberries. So I need a good one. I don't need one that makes me feel like I made a bad choice in life. I picked the wrong fucking melon. If that's the worst choice that I've made, or the worst decision, it's not even a decision. So I was like, fuck this. And I got on Instagram Live, because I've done this before, and we went to Vaughn's, and I got there, I found a melon. It was seeded. I was making a compromise. They didn't have unseeded, but I found one that sounded right. I knocked on it, and it had the right resonance. So I'm like, I'm going to buy this one. I walk in, don't have my wallet, don't have my cash. So I steal the melon. I threw the melon in my car. I got the hot melon in the car, and I get home with the hot melon, and I'm torn. I'm like, that's my community Vaughn's. I've just videoed me stealing from the Vaughn's. They have footage. Be interesting to get both footage together, because as the story unfolds, it becomes quite a tale. So I'm like, I got to go back and pay. So do I get my wallet? And when I'm in the house, I realize, no, let's go to the other Vaughn's and see if they have a seedless watermelon that might be better, and then just go return the one you stole. So, but like, at least have the option to either pay for it or return it or just keep the stolen melon, whatever, but buy yourself some time and go to Vaughn's, the other Vaughn's, and check their melons. So we went to the other Vaughn's. I bought a melon there that I think sounded good, brought it home, cut it open, pretty good. But then I've got the hot melon in the car, so I bring the hot melon back and return it to the wild. It might've been a little traumatized, and I know that somebody who gets it is not gonna know that melon had an adventure with a guy who basically took them hostage, and they'll be eating like sort of like chunks of trauma, seated trauma, not seated, S-E-A-T-E-D, but seated trauma. But nonetheless, I went and released a melon. I went back and I realized, like, well, maybe that melon, maybe I should get that melon. Then I went back because I felt like I missed him and he might have missed me or they. We decided on Mel. Mel the melon, a they. You know, I don't know what genders melons are, but it doesn't matter. Gender fluid melon. So I go back and I placed it in a certain way that I, you know, no one had been, only been 5 minutes. So I went and bought the original melon I stole. So this is really a tale of a lot of, you know, moral conflict. It's a tale of, you know, a lawless country coming to terms with itself. It's a tale of getting away with things, but not getting away with things. You know, ultimately I made the right choice, but there was a lot of levels working in this piece. So if you'd like to go to my Instagram feed and watch the melon heist, you know, you can, you know, kind of feel the weight of it. Feel the weight of, you know, being a criminal for 10 minutes and then turning, you know, and then finding your soul. That's what that's about. And also getting melons. So if that interests you, that's good viewing. And I'm going to reach out to Vaughn's to see if I can get the security material because I think it would really add to the film. So I'm leaving. Well, I'll actually be in Montreal tonight doing my solo show and tomorrow for, I think the place only seats like 120 people. And the gala, I'll let you know how that goes. I'm a little nervous about it. Only because it's like a big, you know, weird Canadian high-profile hosting gig. And I can't remember the last time I did one of those. Anyway, Zainab Johnson is a peer and somebody I started seeing at the store, and I just liked watching her, and I was curious about her life. And she's a comic, obviously, and you can watch her in both seasons of Upload on Prime Video. She's also going to be performing on my gala in Montreal this Saturday at Just for Laughs. And you can go to zainabjohnson.com to see where else she's performing next month. This is me, Mark Maron, talking to Zainab Johnson. Nice to see you.
It's good to see you, too. Never see a comedian on a Monday morning.
You don't?
No.
No. You rarely see them during the day.
Yes.
Unless you socialize with them.
Exactly.
But we live lives. I mean, I'm an older comic. I'm up and doing things.
I was at, I went to the Eid celebration. You know what Eid is?
No.
Okay, so Eid is like an Islamic holiday. There's two of them. Okay. One comes after Ramadan, after the fat, the 30-day fast.
Oh, good. I'm learning things.
And I was at the mosque in Culver City, and it's the Eid celebration, and it's the first one I've been to since COVID, you know, since the pandemic.
Yeah.
And then I see Asif.
Oh, yeah.
You know, Asif, and he's like, Zainab. And I'm like, this is so, I know that we both have this belief and this practice, but I didn't expect to see you here. It was strange.
It was
strange but wonderful all at the same time.
That's nice.
Then we go to the Comedy Store and then tell a bunch of dick jokes.
Right. Sure, dick jokes. But that's interesting because that's two, like, I guess it's the same religion, but two different communities.
Yeah.
Like, where does he come from? I can't remember.
I think he's Indian.
Yeah.
And so I'm black.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's like, it's always kind of wild to me to know the different, like, I'm a Jew, but there's some, you know, more Jewy Jews and less Jewy Jews. And then there's Jews that don't do any Jew stuff.
Yeah. I was in Venice yesterday, yesterday? And I saw, I would call them black, or in California, Latinx Israelites. How do you feel about that?
The guys in the costumes?
Yeah, I mean, I guess, are they costumes? They definitely look like they're walking through a desert.
The Israelite people, they're in New York too, right?
Yes.
You see them in Times Square. But I don't know what those outfits are. I don't really know what religion they are. I don't know that they're representing Jewishness.
Okay.
They're doing something else. I don't want to judge them too harshly, but I know I've seen them yelling in Times Square.
Yeah.
And I don't remember listening too intently.
Yeah.
So I can't claim them. I can't say they're on the same spectrum as I am with the Jew thing.
Okay. I don't have a dog in a fight, nor do I know enough.
No, me
to
neither.
Even...
I mean, like, if they were Hasidic people, then I would be like, yes, we're on the same spectrum somehow.
I grew up with not, I didn't grow up with them, obviously, yeah. But I, in the same neighborhood, I mean, I lived in Williamsburg, you know, and so I definitely saw a lot of Hasidic Jews.
Yes, I can tell by the mild change in tone that not a great experience.
Well,
and I've gotten into trouble with them occasionally because I talk shit about them a lot.
Okay. You know, also, it's like, listen, I'm a New York City kid, so all my classmates for a good portion of my childhood were Jewish kids. I mean, New York
Hasidic
City for
kids?
You. No.
But you didn't, like, you lived in Williamsburg later. Where'd you grow up?
I grew up in Harlem, but I was bussed out, so I went to school on, like, 84, like, downtown, like, you know, like, and so...
Why were they bussed out to there?
No. I was bussed out. Yeah. You know how they take, like, you test out of your, you know, quote-unquote ghetto, and they put you in a school with all white kids, but usually those all white kids are Jewish kids.
Yeah.
And so in seventh and eighth grade, I went to a bunch of bar and bat mitzvah. That was my social life.
So you tested out because you were a smart kid.
Yeah.
And then they sent you to the Jew-filled school.
Yeah.
With the smart Jews.
Yeah.
Well, and that was in Williamsburg.
The smart Jews that are not rich because they're still in public school, they're not in private school.
Right.
Yeah.
So the reasonable Jews that didn't have too much of an attitude.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, that's wild. So you grew up your whole life in Harlem?
Yeah, I was born in Brooklyn. I moved out of Brooklyn when I was 5 years old. I moved to Harlem.
With your whole family?
My entire family. At the time that I moved... My parents, it was eight of us because they had the twins when we got to Harlem. So 9 and 10, it's 13 of us total.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
I mean, where'd you put all those people?
You put them in a hallway. You put them in a kitchen.
Really?
You sleep in a bathroom if you
really?
Have to. Oh, we didn't sleep in a bathroom or the kitchen, but we definitely had bunk beds in the hallway.
Yeah?
Yeah.
I'm going to just be honest. It's like the biggest religion in the world. I don't know shit. About Islam, really.
But you know what? Growing up, as much as I practiced it, I didn't know shit either.
It's like Jews, yeah.
You just listen to your parents.
Yeah.
Yeah. You copy what they do.
Yeah.
But the thing that kind of opened my mind up to religion, period, was I took an elective course in college. Like my favorite courses in college were my electives.
Yeah.
I took the history of religion.
Yeah.
And it opened me up to Christianity, Judaism, and Islam. Mm. You know, and I took like a philosophy class.
Yeah.
And that was
that was it?
Yeah.
Spent a whole life just going along with it.
Yeah.
And then sort of it deepened later.
Yes.
So, okay. So there's a total of how many kids in the
13.
House? Oh my God.
Seven
boys, six girls. So what business was your dad in or your mom?
My dad worked for the MTA.
Wow.
Yeah. He worked for the Metropolitan Transit Authority and my mom stayed at home.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
So it wasn't easy going.
No, we were poor. We were dirt poor.
So how did you all manage? I mean, I guess it's too broad a question. I mean,
well, there were different times. Like I do remember when it was slightly less of us.
Yeah.
And we used to go on, like, we never went on like a family vacation.
No.
Never left like the city, but like we would travel to Queens to go to like Red Lobster. That was like a treat, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Or we would.
But how would you go on
the
train? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Or we would go to, you know, take the D train all the way to Coney Island.
Yeah.
And like that was a day for us, or spend the day in Prospect Park. Like that was a big deal.
So there was a time where all of you were beneath the age of 18.
Yeah.
Or a lot of, so you all, that's crazy.
Yeah. And then, but there were also times where it was really rough. Like I remember times where it's like only condiments in a refrigerator.
Oh, no.
You know, like only condiments and like a few slices of bread, or like heating up our sneakers in like the oven. Like I remember.
Before you went out?
Yeah. Well, it's like you can't afford new sneakers. Like, not before you went out, but like you can't afford new sneakers like at the start of a new school year.
So you heat
and
them
so
to
you wash. Them? Well, you wash them.
Yeah.
But it's like my parents, I remember in one apartment, we had enough for our first Harlem apartment.
Yeah.
We had enough for a washing machine, but not a dryer.
Right.
So it's like we can wash the clothes, but you have to hang them to dry. Right.
Yeah.
And so, you know, maybe my mom made the mistake of like not managing her time right. And it's like we washed the sneakers the night before the first day of school. It's like they're not.
So that's why they went in the oven.
Yeah, they went in the oven. I remember our sneakers.
I thought it was a practical thing.
No.
Like it was so cold that we had to get a good start. We need to warm our shoes up.
No.
Just drying them.
Just drying them, yeah.
So all the siblings, is everyone still around in touch?
Yeah, we're all in touch. No one has passed, thank God.
Yeah. Folks are still around too?
Yeah. Oh, my father passed away when I was like 23 years old,
okay.
I believe.
Yeah.
And so, but yeah, my mom is still, you know, just.
It's still at the same place?
No, she lives in Michigan now.
Michigan,
Lansing, Michigan.
With a big community there.
A huge community. Yeah.
I was just there.
Yeah, it's a huge community.
Yeah, and I went out there and ate some food.
Yeah, more so East Lansing, and then if you go to like right outside
Dearborn.
Of Detroit, Dearborn, exactly.
That's where I went to eat.
Yeah.
That's how I judge everything. It's like, is there interesting food?
Me too.
Yeah.
Listen, if I can go to the most beautiful place in the world, if I haven't eaten good, it hasn't been a good trip.
I wanted to go to India for years only because of the bread.
Really?
And then I never went because it seemed like a shallow reason to go. And
it's, no, that's the perfect reason to go.
Have you been there?
No, but I want to go.
You do?
I want to go simply
for the food.
Yeah.
Let's go.
Let's go. But, I'm serious.
But you know what stops me? It's like, you know, you have to get shots. And everybody who goes to India for any amount of time, they're like, look, you'll be sick for like 4 days. But then after that, it's great.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I don't know. Do you want to be sick for 4 days?
I do because... Listen, you know, this is going to sound really vain and shallow, but I love dropping a few pounds, like annoying.
Yeah, me too. I'm going crazy right now.
Oh, are you?
Yeah, because I was out on the road. Like, I just let myself go for like 3 weeks.
Yeah.
And I'm like crawling out of my skin.
I hear a lot of comedians say that about the road. That never happens to me on the road. If anything, on the road, I come back svelte.
Because you deny yourself because there's nothing to eat, so you don't eat nothing?
Yeah, I either go to the ends of the earth to find what I need, right? And so I'll be the person in freaking Wichita, Kansas, walking when nobody else is walking. I will walk 8 miles
to the Whole Foods?
One. Yes.
Yeah, I know. I do that.
Yes.
I don't walk. You know, you
no,
can get
I
an
walk.
Uber now.
Yeah, no, I walk. That's how I earn it.
Yeah.
That's how I earn it.
So you're nuts.
Yeah. but I never come back with like, I let myself go. I never come back with that story.
Well, I mean, the problem with letting yourself go is that it's fun.
Yeah.
And you sort of make an excuse. You know, I was just in New Mexico. It's like, I got to eat that food. And then Jenny's Ice Cream just sent me a case of ice cream. And I didn't ask for it, but I didn't fight it.
No. You accept ice cream whenever you get ice cream.
But then it doesn't matter. I'm nuts.
I love to hear men say it.
You do?
Because this is like something that people think only women deal with.
But... I'm fucking nuts. I'm full on, like, I have body dysmorphia. I'm all of it.
Most of the people who I've met that can say they have body dysmorphia have been men, and they have been men in the industry.
Really?
Yes.
Well, I would argue that most dudes that you see who are ripped, and that's an eating disorder. It's a healthy one.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a control thing, right?
Yeah.
I mean, one way or the other, it's some kind of control thing.
Yeah.
But I guarantee you, they don't think they look big enough or ripped enough.
Yeah.
I don't have that problem. I'm not looking at my washboard stomach going like, I gotta work a little. But you know a lot of body dysmorphic men?
Not a lot, but... Whenever I've heard that term used or that, you know, like realization, it comes from a man.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But you wouldn't say you have an eating disorder.
Oh, I don't.
Yeah. But you're just aware of it.
No, I eat a lot.
Yeah.
I eat, like, contrary to what I might look like, I eat a whole lot.
Yeah.
But I feel like that's what the vacation is for. Like, that's what I was saying, you know, like on the road, like that's your job. You're doing that so often. You have to maintain a certain level of control because this is, but, oh, if I'm going to India, Mark, I'm going to eat. I'm going to be sick. I'm going to eat some more. Yeah. I'm going to be sick. I don't care.
Yeah.
I don't care.
It's vacation.
Yeah.
Well, I go through periods where I'm very responsible on the road. And then there's periods where it just gets away from me where I don't. Like, you go to some places, you're not going to find a Whole Foods.
No.
Then you got to figure it out. You got to go buy some nuts somewhere.
The first time I went to China, I went to a bunch of cities before I got to like Shanghai and Beijing, which has everything you need. But when I was in Hangzhou, Chengdu, when I couldn't find a thing, I would just get a Snicker bar.
Yeah.
I would just get Snickers, M&M's. I would get what
you
I knew. And I would just drink so much water. That was my way of combating
I was
putting.
When did you go to China?
Like a couple of years ago, maybe like 5 years ago.
To I did do
a whole,
shows?
Yeah.
For who's booking that thing?
At the time, it was Australian comedian named Andy. I don't know Andy's last name.
So you're doing expat shows in all those places?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Did you like it?
I did. I was there once. Yeah, you didn't like it?
It's like going to another planet.
It is. But, I mean, China specifically, it really is.
Yeah, and I just did Beijing and Hong Kong, and the place in Hong Kong, like, in my recollection, the restaurant that we performed in wasn't even built yet.
Yeah.
And in Beijing, it was a little weird because that spy plane had just been captured.
Oh.
So it was kind of tense. Mm-hmm. But just walking around, I thought it was pretty fascinating.
Yeah, I think that my favorite Asian country so far has been Japan. I don't know. To me, it just seems like
the future. Yeah, you hope.
You just land there and it's like, oh, we're in the future.
You hope.
Literally, yeah.
It'd be nice if we had a Japanese future in America. I don't think it's going to pan out that way.
Yeah, I don't think it will either. Yeah. But I remember when I did a show in Shanghai, I just kept hearing an echo. And I wasn't sure why I was hearing an echo. And then I stopped and I realized that there was a guy on a date and he spoke English, but his date didn't. So he was translating everything I was saying.
Into Chinese,
or Mandarin or, you know.
Did you hear a laugh after?
That's what I was waiting for. I was like, am I funny? Ask her. Am I funny? And he was like, no, she's really enjoying it. And I'm like, there's no way for me to verify.
When you go to those places, like, I don't have any desire to, like, it's one and done kind of thing, right? I mean, you're not going to be like, I'm going back to China as soon as I can.
No. I'm hesitant to say it, but no, I didn't have a desire to, like, go back. Not having anything to do with the audience.
No, I get it. I get it.
But just, it's a really long way to travel.
And it's hard.
Yeah.
It's a hard job.
Yeah.
It's a hard enough job. There's sometimes where I do the job where, like, it's like when I said to you the other night, because, like, I'm going to take Esther Pavitsky to Vegas with me.
Yeah.
But I didn't know, I don't know who opens and who doesn't, but you're like, I'm not opening. You know what I mean? And like some of the people that open for me are headliners. So but I had to ask. But there's some things that we do where it's like, I'm done. I'm done with that.
Yeah.
Like, there's just some places I'm not going to perform anymore.
Well, listen, I would open for you at Madison Square Garden.
Okay. Well, let's make that happen.
Yeah. But you want to hear something that's also crazy?
Yeah. What?
8 years ago, I would have never imagined that I would have ever said to Marc Maron, no, I can't open for
well,
you.
Well, 8 years?
I would have never imagined that.
8 years is a long time.
It is.
What happens in 8 years? All right, so wait, let's go back to Harlem and sneakers in the oven.
Yeah.
So what was the expectations, on a family level were your parents supportive of comedy? I mean, what was the original idea for you?
The original,
among all those kids.
The original idea was to finish high school, go to college, and for me specifically, become a math teacher, which I fulfilled.
But that was not a dream.
That wasn't a dream.
It was practical? Why that?
Well, my parents, for me, I think it's because I watched my mom... Mm. My mom got married to my dad when she was in college. He had just, my dad is 7 years older than my mom, and he had just finished, he had just gotten out the Navy when they got married. And my mom got married to my dad at 19. She had my oldest sister when she was 20. And I watched my mom as a kid go to college and never finish.
Mm.
I even remember my mom was a theater major.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and I remember her putting me and my brother in a play. I guess she didn't do the work. Didn't cast the people she needed. So I'm like this freaking, 9-year-old kid doing a Raisin in the Sun at Queens College, and at the when I was
so
little.
So she was directing it?
Yeah, when I was little, I knew that wasn't right. But it's like, even when I think back at it, I'm like, dang, it's like she had so many of us and she was still really just trying to fulfill her own dreams and goals.
Uh-huh.
And she tried so hard, but she was the mother of so many, you know?
Well, that's a choice.
It is. But so for me, seeing that, that translated to me as go to college and finish. Nothing comes before that.
Yeah.
I didn't discover comedy until later.
Right. Was your dad born into the religion?
No. Both my parents were born Christian.
Okay.
Yeah. Converted apart from one another. My dad converted under the Nation of Islam.
Yeah.
And my mom converted under Sunni Islam.
With the mosque that you went to when you were growing up,
mm-hmm.
was that affiliated with Nation of Islam?
Yeah.
Oh,
I went to, yeah, I went to the Malcolm, Masjid Malcolm Shabazz, which is on 116th and Lenox Avenue in Harlem. And then before that, I went to the Masjid Taqwa in Brooklyn. Those were both temples that are affiliated with the Nation of Islam.
They're historic places?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Did it seem politicized in any way or just religious?
No, to me, it seemed just religious. But my father was very political. My father used to talk about the white man all the time.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, like
we're a problem.
I've met a few of you.
Yeah.
yeah, he used to, you know, he definitely had very strong opinions. I would say like the first 10 or 12 years of my life. But then I noticed something changed in him. And I don't know. He wasn't always a part of the Nation of Islam. Like my father didn't make the pilgrimage to Hajj, but I interpreted his change as the same thing that happened to like Malcolm X, which is you kind of realize like, oh, there's this faith, there's this religion that you believe in, but there's but then there's this black nationalist group and those two things are separate.
Right.
You know?
Oh, really? Yeah. So you go to college.
He stopped calling you guys the devil.
He did. Okay. Well, I don't know there's any reason to ever stop.
Now, I mean, listen, now he has, my sisters have married a bunch of white men. So.
Really?
Yeah.
So he has a bunch of white grandkids, half white?
Half white, half Japanese, half, like all
wow.
mixed. Yeah.
I don't know why that's so exciting. is it just the way it is?
It is what it is.
Are any of them more religious people? Any of your siblings, did they become more religious?
No, I mean, I have one brother who goes to jail a lot, and he gets really religious when he's in jail. Yeah, he comes home, and he be on his hadith hard for like the first couple of months out of jail, and then, you know. But one of my siblings converted to Catholicism, and that was the thing that kind of blew our minds.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's an interesting choice.
I mean, that's from one extreme to the other, right?
Yeah, and also, like, you know, not a great reputation that religion these days.
But he married a Spanish woman.
Okay,
and that's
different.
Yeah,
you do what you got to do.
Yeah,
I guess.
The Puerto Ricans and the Dominicans in New York, they're Catholic.
Yeah,
you know. So
now he's in.
He's in.
All right.
In Jesus Christ's name.
Yeah.
Sorry. I've never said that before in my life.
How was the shift for him? You don't know? Do you ever do it? I don't know how people do that.
I don't know, but I know that we roasted him.
Yeah?
Yeah.
And he took it?
He took it. He took it. We roast him all the time. We're like, ugh.
It's about her. Come
here
on.
He comes.
The Jesus guy.
Oh, God.
That's great. So you taught math, you graduated college and taught math?
Yeah, I taught math and science, but I was never, but I taught.
Were you good at math? Are you good at it?
Now, I'd have to reimmerse myself, I would say I'm pretty good with numbers.
Yeah.
And I'm not afraid of it.
Yeah.
You know,
up until what level are you good? All the way, like trig and everything?
Calculus. Oh, yeah,
really?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah,
I couldn't get through algebra.
It wasn't until really. Oh no, I was doing algebra in fourth and fifth grade.
So you got so that's why you pursued it, because you were good at it.
Yeah, I was, and I don't know if they're still doing this in schools, but you know when you take the standardized test.
Yeah.
I was always in a 99th percentile with math, always.
So you had a natural
math
brain.
Yeah, I was pretty high in reading, like, and it's still in the 90s, but 99 always.
Yeah.
In math. So the moment my mom was like, oh, we could get her into a better school.
Let's do it.
Yeah.
That's great. So you get out, you teach, where are you teaching?
In the Bronx.
Like high school?
Middle school, like an elementary school that went all the way up to middle school. But my plan was to teach high school.
Yeah.
But I just never made, I just ended up moving to California.
So what happens? Teaching kids in middle school, was it disheartening?
No. So the school that I taught very briefly at, it was a charter school. Yeah. And I feel like charter schools, those are where you have involved parents.
Right.
And so I feel like those kids were great
for
the most part.
Right.
You know, you can see things in kids that they can't see in themselves. Like I remember this one kid, and I won't say his name, but I remember I knew that he was going to be on the a part of the LGBTQ. You know, I knew it.
Sure.
When he was that age, I knew, although he didn't know it, and I could tell that it was because he didn't know it. It was causing so much frustration, and even the way he interacted with kids is because he didn't really know what was happening to him.
Right, right.
And now, when I see, whenever you know, like maybe a few years ago, he messaged me on Facebook, and like he is not only is he out and proud and queer, he's also like gothic. You know what I'm saying? Like emo or whatever.
Sure.
Like, but I saw that. I saw all of that
when he was,
you know, and at the time, 13. I'm just like a 22 year old. You know,
sure.
But I, you don't say it. But
well, no, what are you going to say exactly?
Yeah.
How would you say it? Sure, of course you know. You kind of know.
You know, like.
But you didn't find it discouraging teaching because the environment was good.
Because the environment was good. My kids were good. But I did have the epiphany. And I think normally things happen, like people have epiphanies when things are going, you know, bad.
Yeah.
But I remember this day being perfect.
Different type of epiphany.
Yeah, I remember this day in that classroom being perfect. They were so well behaved.
Yeah.
They were motivated. It was quiet. And I remember standing there watching them be like stellar students. And I thought, I can't do this.
Huh.
And I didn't know what I was going to do. But I knew, I'm telling you, I knew.
It wasn't like a sad moment?
No, it was an aha moment.
You just saw your whole life.
Yeah, I'm like, this is actually not the plan. This is not the path.
Mm.
And then my friend was like, my friend was a spoken word artist at the time. And she's like, I'm moving to LA. I'm going to be famous. And I'm like,
how'd she do?
I mean, I'm more Googleable. I think she's doing okay. But I mean, I'm definitely,
sure.
You know.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, you picked a more a broader format, medium comedy.
Yeah,
know? Spoken word's pretty specific.
Yeah, it is. It is.
She could be huge in that world, and we wouldn't know.
Yeah, I mean, she's an actor now.
But... Okay. So you had that epiphany. Well, yeah, I think that's interesting that it happens, that those epiphanies, the epiphanies that happen in bad spaces are usually sort of like, oh, fuck. I'm in trouble.
Yeah.
I gotta change.
It's like rock bottom.
Right.
Yeah.
But the epiphanies that happen just passively are kind of, they're more interesting.
Yeah.
Because you don't know where it came from. You just realize that you just weren't, because it wasn't even unhappy, really.
But you know what? I think, I never thought about this until just this moment. It's like sometimes things have to be perfect for you, because that's when it was the most quiet.
Sure.
I think if it was chaotic, I don't know if I would have gotten the message.
Or
you
could
know?
Trust it even.
Yeah, but it was so quiet.
Yeah.
And I was so peaceful. And then it just came, it was like, and I mean, I may have physically done that. My head shook. Like,
oh
God,
exciting?
You got to get out of here.
Yeah. Oh,
you
so
know?
Was that, you had to
yeah,
go.
Yeah, I had to. I was like, oh
But you
no.
didn't know what?
I didn't know, but then I moved to LA.
So you just moved to LA to act?
She said to be famous, and I knew I couldn't let her be famous without me. Who wants to be the friend of the famous person?
Yeah.
Nobody.
So you had to go out there and be famous too?
So that was it. I was like, I'm going to be famous too. How? I don't know.
Really?
I mean, I have parameters. I have boundaries in my life. I knew I wasn't going to do porn, you know?
You drew that line.
Yeah, too. Like I'm too much of a prude, you know? Like I knew I wasn't going to do porn. I knew I wasn't going to do...
It's just sort of sad that was on the table as you're heading out. Let's make a list of how we're not going to be famous.
I knew I wasn't going to do porn. I knew I wasn't going to rob a bank. You know what I'm saying? There's certain things that are like really on the far sides of the spectrum that I knew I wasn't going to do.
Well, good for you.
You know.
But comedy wasn't really...
No, comedy was not even a thought I didn't even think that it was something that I could do. I never thought about it.
Did you watch comedy?
Yeah, I loved comedy.
You did?
My mom snuck me into a comedy club when I was like 11.
Do you remember it?
I do.
Who was on?
I don't remember the specific comedians, but I think at the time the host was...
Where was it? Was it like the West End, like the West End Gate? The one up by Columbia?
No, it was... it was in Harlem. It was like Uptown Comedy Club.
Oh, Uptown Comedy Club. Right. Yeah, yeah, yeah,
yeah,
yeah, yeah, yeah, yeah, yeah. Greer Barnes.
Yeah, possibly.
Yeah.
But even in college, I would go to the Cellar.
Sure.
I would go to the Boston Comedy Club, and that would be like where I would pregame.
The Boston.
Yeah.
Hmm.
when I was like a freshman in college, I would pregame.
Where'd
there
you go to college?
Before I went to City College in New York.
Yeah. Sure.
But my friend, she went to NYU.
Yeah.
And so that was her like stomping ground, you know? And so we would go there before we went to, like, before we were legal to be in nightclubs and everything, we would just go to comedy clubs.
Yeah.
We knew some of the comedians, so they wouldn't ask for our ID.
Yeah.
And then we would go to like nightclubs after that.
Yeah.
Nobody, we were like young, pretty girls.
Yeah.
So they didn't ask for our IDs. We were just
New
in
York.
There partying.
Who were the comics you knew back when you were in high school?
Keith Robinson.
Keith.
I remember watching him. Greer, definitely.
Yeah.
Bill Burr was like one of my favorite people to see and watch when I was like 18 years old.
When he had all that hair?
I guess.
Yeah, yeah, that red hair.
Yeah. I just remember the attitude and the anger, you know?
Yeah, yeah,
and like the rant, you know?
Yeah.
And then I remember being at the Comedy Store years later, sitting next to Bill Burr.
Yeah.
And I was like, you know, you're one of my favorite comedians. He was like, what? And I was like, yeah. He was like, shut up. Like,
Why would he be surprised? It was more surprising that you were there that long. I wonder what year that was. Neil Brennan still a door guy at the Boston?
Ooh, no. This was like around like 2003, 2004.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
So he was out. So like the Boston was almost over. Probably.
Yeah, exactly. I remember Kevin Hart, like before he was like Kevin Hart.
Sure.
You know?
Yeah, I do too. That wasn't that long ago.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
He just took over the world somehow.
Mm-hmm.
So when you get out here, what did you start doing first? Did you guys get a place? Tell me the horrible entrance into Los Angeles.
I got a place, a 300 square foot apartment in Silver Lake.
300 square feet, that's a closet.
Yeah. You could see everything, the kitchen from the living room, like everything. It was right next to a bus stop, so I heard every time the bus came, but that made me feel like I was back home, so it was comforting.
Yeah. Need a little bit of noise.
Little bit of noise.
Yeah.
So I had a bit of success when I first got here because, you know, I was still like, you know, like very youthful looking.
Yeah.
And so I did like a lot of interstitials with Nickelodeon. Like they weren't
actual
commercials.
Did you have an agent or how'd you do it? You just went on a casting call?
Yeah. Like I would just go look at like breakdowns and stuff like that. And it was like very easy for me. Like I have a good smile. It was very easy for me to be like,
yeah.
I know I could say lines like, you know?
Yeah.
But then I taught. That's what that makes
Substitute?
It easier. Yeah, when you can teach, it makes it you feel like you can move anywhere in the world. Because everybody always needs teachers.
And you sign up to be a substitute? Is
I
that
signed
how it
up
works?
To be a substitute, and here's what I didn't know. When you sign up to be a substitute, like it's really hard to get placed in actual schools in LA because they have their go-to substitutes. So what you do first is they send you to like the jails.
Really?
Yes. And so they call them campuses, so you think you're going to like Stuyvesant, but no, you are going to a jail. You know, like it may be like a juvenile detention center, but it's like a jail. So there were times where I remember three things stick out to me. Once I was on a camp, like in a jail.
Yeah.
But they were able to learn together. So they were in the classrooms together.
Yeah.
And I remember sitting down at the desk, looking at like what I was supposed to cover.
Yeah.
And I guess there were like black gangs and like Mexican gangs.
In your classroom.
Yeah. And immediately one of the black boys came in and immediately started yelling at one of the Mexican boys, "You killed my cousin."
Yeah.
"You killed my cousin." And I'm just, and then it was not like a big commotion, but it was like a clear standoff, you know? And I can't remember, like I didn't black out or anything, but I feel like I tried to get them under, like, please just have a seat. I have to go over. But I remember being like, you know, I grew up in New York, so I wasn't like completely naive.
Right.
So I was like, listen, that like I hit them with like the Michelle Pfeiffer, freaking Viola Davis. I was like, yo, what you're saying sucks. Like, that sounds awful, but right now, there's a lesson plan. Let me at least get through this lesson plan. And I just remember like getting through that day. Like them feeling like, like she's a reasonable person. That's reasonable. Yeah, they let us come into the classroom. All she's trying to do is her job. Let's let her, what you got to teach, you know? And I remember going through it. And that was, I remember, that wasn't the last day that, I did a jail. But I was like, okay, I definitely can't go into a jail where they have like communal learning, right? So then, and then these jails are not like, this is not like LA proper. You're freaking driving, you know, near Six Flags. You're driving like to, freaking way deep in the valley for these things.
Selma or somewhere.
So then shortly after that, I go to a campus and the, some of them, like, so everybody is like really in their cells, but their cells surround like the common area. And some people have the privilege to be in that common area and be learning in that common area. And I didn't have a lot of kids, and these are all boys. So it's like maybe like seven or eight boys. But right when I'm there that day, a fight breaks out. A fight breaks out. And so they start to like try to lock everybody back in. But I'm already with like, guys, you know, like young guys, but guys, you know, anywhere from like 16 to maybe like 21 or something, you know, there. And I'm in this guy, I can't even tell you what he looks like now. He just protected me. Protected me until the threat was like, you know, squashed. And then I remember thinking that day, okay, I cannot go to jails anymore.
It got scary.
It's like, you know, fool me once, shame me, fool me. It's like, you got to say you're driving. You don't even have the gas. Why are you putting yourself in? As much as I have been lucky enough for the these young men to have some sort of respect to like, you know. But it's like there were dangerous situations. And then the last time, I remember the last time I taught in, within this like program. I went to a place on Wilshire that doesn't look like a school, but it's like learning within like a building, right? And I remember it was all going fine. The kids weren't really listening to me, but I wasn't in like any threat of danger. And then during my lunch break, I sat in like what was considered, I guess, like the teacher's lounge or something. And I'm eating grapes and like this 16-year-old, really good looking 16-year-old boy comes in the room. And he's like, can I have some grapes? And I'm like, you really want, now just remember, I'm like 24 at the time. So I'm 24, but he probably thinks that I'm closer to his age,
right?
And so he's like, can I have some grapes? And I'm like, you really want grapes? And he was like, I mean, yeah, I want to, I want some grapes and I want to like get to know you. When I tell you, I laughed so hard. And then I was like, I said, oh, you think I'm younger than I am? I said, here, I'm going to give you some grapes, but I'm like, I'm a complete adult. So sit down, let's have some grapes. We can like, let me get to know you. But like, you know,
this ain't happening.
Respectfully. I'm, you know, I could be your auntie. I could be your older. I remember saying that to him, like, I could be your older sister. Like,
You have that land.
It was like completely. I'm telling you, like, I think a lot in a lot of situations, how I respond, people go, ah, that's reasonable.
And also you're grounded, you know? You know, you're in your body and you know what you feel and you have principles. So, you know, they're not going to fuck with you. It helps in comedy.
I mean, it's been saving me so far.
I mean, a lot of people don't, and they're kind of ungrounded, or they, you know, and they're nervous and they're afraid. I imagine growing up with, you know, 12 siblings in the situations, like, you know, you got to be pretty diplomatic and but also sort of strong, right?
And I'm a middle kid. But also, too, it's like I think a lot of people, I probably, because I did grow up with so many different personalities. It's like I can pretty much see like, oh, that this reminds me of my brother or this reminds, you know.
Familiar somehow.
You
have experience with it. With every different kind of kid.
But I also remember having this thought when I related to a friend of mine when I was done with that day. I was like, wow, it's like I have no interest in like a little kid. But like if I were in a different place in my life, maybe feeling like constantly rejected or insecure. It's like that was a good looking kid who was interested in me. You know what I'm saying? And people who, like, thank God I was kind of like, have always been, like, my baseline is pretty secure. You know?
That's good.
Because I was like, this is how it happened. You know,
that's how people like, get into trouble.
This is how people get into trouble. Even when I became a comedian, I used to feature for Jimmy Schubert. You know who Jimmy Schubert is?
Yeah, of course I know Jimmy Schubert.
I used to feature for Jimmy Schubert when I first started.
Him and I go way back.
And
there's a lot of lessons to learn there.
Yeah, he was the first person to take me on the road with him.
Yeah.
When I was on stage, we would be like, I remember we did a bunch of clubs and like all the improvs in Florida.
Oh my God.
And I remember being on stage and the women.
Yeah.
They could be on dates. They could be sitting right next to their even male partners. So these aren't even queer women, right? They could be sitting next to their husbands and they would be like flirting with me, winking at me, mouthing things to me, doing things with their breast while I'm on stage. Like, and I would be on stage thinking like, oh my God, imagine if I were a guy who was like susceptible to the, you know what I'm saying? Like they would come up to me after the show, feel on me, do, you know? And I'm like, this is like a tough, this is like.
But that sounds, is that something that has continued throughout your career? I mean, it sounds like Florida.
Oh, well, yeah. I mean, yeah, that might have just been Florida. Now that I think about it, I never really.
Florida's weird.
I never separated it. I mean, no, women do flirt.
Yeah.
You know, they do flirt with me.
But that sounded like heavy. Like
that, no, I mean, it was so much so that I remember it.
Right.
Like, I don't remember. Men and women come to my shows all
sure.
the time
yeah.
and do what they do.
Right.
You know, but. That I remember feeling so uncomfortable with what a specific woman was doing to me while I was on stage. And I was only up there for 20, 25 minutes.
Yeah.
And I was thinking like, wow, imagine if I was like a single guy, you
yeah,
know,
yeah.
like a single guy interested in this. This, you know,
yeah.
this would be my playground.
Sure. I mean, I think my experience is a lot of people get into entertainment because they do get attention
yeah.
from women.
Mm-hmm.
That's a prime motivator.
Yeah.
Early on.
Yeah.
I don't think it's the same for women.
No. I don't think
I can't,
so.
I don't know that I've talked to any women that are like, I want to do comedy so these guys will hit on me.
Yeah. When I get off stage sometimes.
Yeah.
And I find this very, like I know they think they're complimenting me, but I find it very insulting, but I just smile. They'll be like, are you a model?
Yeah.
And I'll be like, no, you just saw me do an hour of
yeah,
comedy.
Yeah.
And they're like, but you know, it could be easy. Like, you don't have to do this.
Yeah.
And I'm like, did you find me funny? And they're like, no, yeah, like we loved you, but you know, like there's an easier road
sure.
for you. And I'm like,
yeah,
that's so crazy. That's crazy.
But you knew that it could have been easier. Did you ever think that?
No, because I've never like looked at my life like that. Like, like. There's certain privileges that are always cherries on top,
yeah,
right, of
right.
any situation. But I don't think that that's what was, I don't think that that's how I was prepared for the world.
Yeah, also, I think it's fundamentally shallow and it would probably be self-deceiving to do that.
Yeah, but also, even if I did think that, what I'll never do is go up to a sink. I'm not going to go up to a magician after yeah. I've watched an hour of his magic show
and then say,
you know, you could be a wrestler.
Sure, sure. Yeah.
I'm never going to do it.
I think it's, I think that's one of these general kind of weird, you know, comedy is the realm of runty people.
Yeah.
So I think that it was probably meant as a genuine compliment.
Absolutely.
That's sort of like, yeah, you don't look like other comics.
Yeah. I think people, I'm sure that's what she was, you know, what people
sure.
are thinking, but that's not what comes,
no,
what you think and what comes out of your mouth.
Yeah.
Can be drastically different.
Of course, and how we take things.
Yeah.
You know, I get it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's like, for years when I was doing the podcast, people would be like, they would come to the comedy shows and they just start talking to me about my life and about the podcast. I'm like, the comedy? You know, it's like, yeah, it's fine. But did you get that thing fixed in your house? I'm like, so when do you start doing comedy? How does that happen?
I started doing comedy in the end of 2010.
Yeah.
Yeah, and
so you're substitute teaching. You're doing interstitials for Nickelodeon.
Yeah, for
picking
like,
up work here and there.
Yeah, for like my first 2 years out here, and Ian Edwards,
uh-huh.
who's a comedian.
Yeah,
he says, "Hey, you know, BET is casting for this show. They need funny girls." And I'm like, "Well, I'm not."
How'd you know Ian?
I met him one day at the Cellar.
Oh, back in the day.
But not, no. Like, he was visiting New York.
Oh, okay.
And he was doing a spot at the Cellar, and he knew all the other comedians that I had gotten familiar with, so.
Did you remember, I remember Ian when he had dreads.
I didn't know him. After I met him and got to know him, he showed me those pictures.
The headshots?
Yeah. I'm like, oh, like, he was heavier, he had dreads. I'm like, oh, this is a completely different person.
That's how I remember him when he started.
Yeah.
So you knew him, you met him.
Yeah, so he, and so, like, when I was in college, my friend and I, we used to come here, like, on spring break, and I remember once I don't know how, but for one spring break we came here, it was when Soul Plane had premiered, and we went to the premiere, like, everything, and that was just, for me, like, L.A. was so, that was, like, the dream, because I would come here during spring break. It's like, you come here for a long weekend, you eat brunch, you go to the beach, and you go to freaking A-list parties, you know, because you're just like a young, cute girl.
Yeah.
And then when you move here, it's a rude awakening.
Yeah.
Well, for me, it was.
Yeah.
It was like, oh my God, I don't know anybody. I'm so lonely. I
can be pretty lonely here.
Yeah, it's so freaking lonely. Yeah. I lived in Silver Lake. I lived like at the
Silver with your
Lake
friend North. Though. Were you living with your friend?
No, by myself.
Okay.
But she lived like maybe like three blocks, like walking distance away from me. I would get up having nothing to do. I would get up and walk from Silver Lake to Beverly Hills, to Santa Monica.
Oh, no. It's like that New York thing. It's like, I'm going to walk.
I would go into open houses on the way.
That's just
like,
sad.
Like, how much is this going for?
It can be pretty isolating here, and it can really break you.
Yeah.
So Ian tells you, he says
so casting. Ian says that they're casting for you. They need funny women. That's what he says. They need funny black girls. That's what he said.
Yeah.
And I said, well, I don't know why you called me.
Yeah.
And he was like, because you're funny. Yeah. I'm like, no, I'm not.
Yeah.
He said, you are funny. Just go. I said, I don't know. I mean, I'm arguing with him.
Yeah.
I don't know what you're talking about. Or maybe you don't know. Like, I know we don't know each other well, but what I'm not is funny.
Yeah.
And he's like, just go.
Right.
I end up going.
Yeah.
They end up casting me for this prank show. I end up pranking a bunch of people.
Yeah.
I've made friends, you know, with the other cast people. Some are like my close friends to this day.
Yeah.
And after that, I started taking classes at Groundlings. I started doing, like, I've joined a bunch of, like, sketch groups, perform. Like,
really?
We'll perform, like, at the Improv and the Comedy Store, with a sketch group, you know? And then...
So you found a community.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then one day, out of nowhere, I went to a comedy show. My friend said, come with me to this comedy show. And I was like, she was like, yeah, it's all women.
Yeah.
And my friend is performing. And I'm like, oh, okay, I'll go. And I went, and I didn't really enjoy it.
Watching it?
Yeah. I didn't really find those
Was it like a mic?
No.
Or was it like a real show?
It was a real show.
Yeah.
And I just didn't find them very funny.
Sure.
And I think something clicked in me then, because it wasn't like, I didn't just have like a basic opinion, like, they're just not funny to me. I was picking it apart.
Right.
I was picking apart, like, I wonder why she would say this, but this is the joke. Like, I mean, out of nowhere was happening
in my
mind.
This is the second epiphany.
Yes.
Another calm epiphany.
And then, I didn't know this, but... Later, this casting director that I now know, I went to Vegas with a friend, and we went to a big like comedy. I think they did like Def Comedy Jam. Like when Def Comedy Jam came back, they did like a Vegas show of it.
Yeah,
and I remember coming back and reenacting everybody's sets. And when I saw this casting director later, like after I'd started working as a comedian, she was like, you know, I knew you were going to be a comedian before you knew. And I was like, no, how did you know? And she was like, because that, like, we were at my boyfriend's apartment. Like, she was with my boyfriend's roommate.
Yeah.
So that's the reason why we were in the same vicinity, you know, like that's what brought us together that day. She was like, that day when you were in, you know, at your boyfriend's house, she was like, and you just launched into imitating all the comedians and then like rewriting the things that you felt like didn't work. She said, I knew in that moment what you were going to do, although I knew you didn't know it yet.
Yeah.
And I was like, very interesting.
Yeah.
And then I remember one day I was working like a 9-to-5 I was working. A friend of mine at the time was like a manager, and he had to fire his assistant. He's like, "Can you come and, you know, be my assistant?"
Show business manager?
Yeah, yeah. Talent manager. And he's like, "Could you be my assistant?" And I'm like, "Yeah, I need, you know, I could use the money." I always tell this story, and I feel so bad now telling it, but it's the truth. The only reason why I said yes is because at the time I was virtually window shopping on Net-a-Porter. And I saw these $1,500 Chloe boots that I just had to have.
Yeah.
I just had to have them.
Yeah.
And I'm like, how can I? And so right as I'm trying to debate, like, do I pay my rent or do I get these boots? He calls and is like, "Can you come work?"
And I'm like, "Can you buy me these boots?"
I was like, how much will I make by the end of the week? And it was like a close enough amount to the boots. And I was like, "Yeah." And I called one of my sisters and I'm like, "I just got a job, but I need you to send me money now for these boots. I'll give it back to you in a week. I just got a job. I promise you did." And my sister purchased the boots for me. I sent her my first check. I sent it all to my sister.
Yeah.
And I had those boots for years. I recently sold them on a vintage website.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Somebody else wanted the boots.
What kind of boots?
They were Chloe boots. They were thigh-high boots. Oh. Here's the reason why they were important to me, Mark. Yeah. This is a really big part of my story that I never talk about.
Yeah.
When I was 17 years old, I got hit by a truck.
Really?
Yeah.
Why would you lie about that? But like bad? Was it bad?
Super bad. Can I get up?
Yeah. Oh my God, that's a massive scar. So the truck ran over your legs?
So.
Wow.
So the truck kind of like pinned me in between a car and the truck.
Oh my God. When you were crossing the street?
I was pushing the back of the car because the car turned up, like shut down. But I don't know how it shut down because at the time,
you were driving it?
No, I'm 17. I was a New York City kid. Like I had no concept of cars. Yeah. I was a passenger.
Oh.
And then the car just shut off. So I don't know if it was gas. I don't know if it was oil. I didn't know how cars worked.
Yeah.
You know, I would be better starting up a train before I could tell you how a car worked.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And so, but the driver was like, the gas station was so close. And the driver was like, "Just get out and push." And me and the other girl in the car, it was three of us in the car. So one stayed in and then two of us got out and pushed the back of the car. And then as I remember getting out and pushing, and I remember like joking with the girl, I had just had new sneakers. And I was like, "This better not mess up my sneaker."
Yeah.
And then I woke up in an ambulance for like a few seconds. And I remember the ambulance, you know, ambulance driver. I remember one of them cutting off my clothes and asking me like what who was the president or it's like, "You think I know who the president is? I can't vote yet. I don't know who the president is." You know, I mean, you know, I probably knew, but whatever.
Sure.
Drunk driver. So the boots were so important because they were like fashionable, but also they served a very practical purpose.
They cover everything up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like, "Oh my God, I'm gonna be freaking so fly." But also they're going to, you know, mask this thing that happened to me.
Yeah.
So I had to get these boots.
How long did it take to recover from that?
I don't know if I've ever fully recovered. Like, I'm like, that's, it's a part of me now.
No, but I mean, like, just the physical therapy and everything. I mean, it sounds
like it must have been a year.
Yeah.
But even now, like, you know, I'm like really active, but still this causes complications that maybe someone who is as like active and fit as me wouldn't have, that I have to be mindful of and aware of.
What got broken?
Both tib fibs in both legs.
Oh my God.
Yeah. Oh, I have like hip damage. I have a bar, like a metal rod in my left leg. A lot of like, so you saw the bottom, but like the top is like a lot of skin grafting because you just like, you have to take the skin from somewhere.
Yeah.
It's like I have like limited, like almost no dorsiflexion in my left ankle. But that's what's so cool. That's why when I'm on stage and I'm like, I mean, you hear my comedy, it's very personal, you know? And so sometimes when people like reduce me to like, "You're just so beautiful," I'm like, "You don't even know me. You don't even know the half of it." You know?
Yeah, like, sure. Why don't label me, because it erases me in a way.
Yeah. I tried to tell jokes about the accident, though, very early in my career. Yeah. I remember thinking it was very, not thinking it was funny, but thinking like, this is how you overcome things. How do I make this? And eventually I will.
You haven't yet, though?
No, I did it one. They don't believe me.
Huh.
I did it one time on a show, on Joel Kim Booster's show, and they didn't believe me. And then I pulled, just like I did to you, then I pulled my pants up and I showed them.
Yeah.
And then they were like, oh! And then everything I said after that, they were able to laugh. But if I don't show them, it's like I think they think like I'm trying to be like, oh, she's just a hot girl trying to, do you get what I'm saying?
Right,
like,
to undercut her hotness.
Yeah, it's like, you know, when you see like a skinny girl that's like, I feel fat today. It's like, bitch, shut up.
Yeah,
you know what I'm saying?
Sure.
I think that's how they look at me. But then when I show them.
It's odd that comedy's difficult for pretty women.
Yeah.
My second wife was a comic, and she was
really?
A model before that, and you know, there was just a lot of focus on, you know, trying to be humble around being beautiful, because it's not like a beautiful people's game.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
No, it's not.
And it's actually an obstacle.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. It's an obstacle, but it's also an obstacle no one wants to hear about.
Yeah, well, that's it. You know, you can't complain.
Yeah, you can't.
But you gotta almost have to be more funny. You have to get them to forget.
Yeah. Exactly.
You can't, you know, like either that or hypersexualize for a character.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Well, that must have been just, so you were homebound for a year?
I was in a hospital for a year.
Oh my God, that's like life defining. Did you think you were going to die? Or wasn't it like that?
I did not think that I was going to die because.
Do you think you were ever going to be able to walk correctly?
I still don't walk correctly, but you don't know that. I know that.
No, I'm going to watch.
Yeah, watch. I don't care.
But you didn't think you were going to die.
I didn't think I was going to die because I have no recollection of the trauma.
Mm.
I know all the trauma of the aftermath trauma.
Sure.
But not the...
Hitting of the...
Yeah. You know...
Went out immediately.
But here's when I knew I could take a joke.
Yeah.
So I'm laying in a hospital. I'm in ICU.
Yeah.
And I'm like, my face, like my head is like laying to the left side, right?
Yeah.
And at this point, I've been like basically in a medically induced coma. Right, to bring down the pain, like I'm going through surgeries and stuff.
How long were you in a medically induced coma?
Like probably about 2 weeks.
Wow.
Right.
Yeah.
And so, and it's traumatic for my family. Like my dad has to stop where he has to come, and now he's, you know, like by my side, because this didn't happen in New York. I was visiting in Atlanta. Right. So I'm away from home. So my mom gets a call like they tell my mom that I'm dead. I'm not dead. You know, like it's traumatic. Right?
Oh, my
but
God.
But I am not conscious through any of this. Right.
Yeah.
I wake up to people by my side, you know. But I'm in the bed, and I'm in the hospital bed, and my head is like leaning to the left. So you can only see the right side of my face. Mm. Right. But the right side of my face was really traumatic. I'm surprised that without any plastic surgery to my face that it healed. Like that I looked the way I have had no plastic surgery, nothing to my face.
Did you get dragged on the road? How did it get so bad? You were pinned between two cars, but then what happened? How'd you?
I think so from how it was told to me, I was pinned between two cars and the truck backed up and then drove off. And a woman who saw it in her car followed the truck and called the cops on her cell phone, and the cops cut him off at an intersection. So I think for me, it's just like the glass, the breaking of the glass, the fall, you know, just like the hitting the concrete, you know, being like I was knocked unconscious. So
what glass broke?
I don't know, but I definitely had like a lot of cuts and gashes. Like I have them all over. If you look at my body, I have them all over.
Wow.
I have them all over.
Yeah.
Like little things that people wouldn't notice. I have them all over, like in my scalp. Like, I have them all over.
Okay.
Yeah. but.
So you're laying to the left.
Yeah. And so my face, I'm unrecognizable, right? It's not just swollen, but it's cut up. It's everything, right? So my high school basketball coach, he comes, I guess he came to like, because me and the other girl, we were like his athlete. Like we were his freaking kids.
So you were a basketball star.
Yeah. So he comes down and this is what wakes me up. Like this is the first thing that brings me to consciousness, right? I hear him saying my name.
Yeah.
And I'm like, And then I'm like, oh, that's like people, you know. And he sees the right side of my face, which is like unrecognizable.
Yeah.
And I hear him say, I hear him like crying, like, that's not Zaynab. That's like, that can't be her. She was not only like an athlete, but she was also the same in comedy. Like she didn't have to play basketball. She could have been a model. You know what I'm saying? It was that same. It like, no, that can't be her. She doesn't look like that. And then because I hear him saying that, I turn over to look in his direction. And then the left side of my face is regular.
Yeah.
And so he says, oh shit, it's the Phantom of the Opera. And I just bust out laughing. And I didn't, of course, like at that moment, I'm 17 years old. Yeah. I don't think like, oh, I could take a joke. But when I think back on, I'm like, I could take a joke.
Well, yeah.
Like, I laughed in that moment.
So that was, did you have dreams of being a professional athlete and all that?
Or
at least playing in college and all that stuff?
Yeah, I think that the WNBA was like a few years in, you know? And so it felt more possible than anything.
And you were a good player?
Yeah. So
this whole thing shattered your life.
Yeah.
And we just brought it up an hour into a conversation.
But you know what, Mark? I don't see it as shatter. I see it as a pivot.
Sure. No, I get it. But I mean, it's a big transition.
Yeah.
You know, you overcame.
Yeah.
I get it. And in retrospect, it's a pivot.
Yeah.
But when you're 17, you know, I don't know that you were laying in that bed going like, this is just a pivot.
No, it definitely felt like
life ending.
Absolutely. Yeah, but my boyfriend still loved me, and that meant a lot.
Same boyfriend?
We're not together now, but yeah. Not together now.
I was going to say, wow. He's
but he came to one of my comedies. Years ago, when I was JFL new face, came to my
Montreal,
showcase.
Yeah.
Yeah, he came to my showcase audition.
Did he live up there?
No.
Oh, the audition.
It was in New York. He came to my showcase audition, and I had a shaved head, and I remember he was looking at me like, he couldn't believe that I was the girl that he had been with. Like, we were boyfriend and girlfriend from like 15 to 19, you know? Like, he couldn't believe. He was looking at me like I was an alien. Like, wow, look at you.
Yeah.
You know, like.
Was he happy for you?
He was.
Yeah.
But still, like, you could tell, like, speechless.
Yeah.
Speechless. And, like, you're funny. Like, speechless.
Yeah. Oh my God, that's crazy.
And then when I start working for
got your boots.
I got my boots. But I was there for like, working for like a week for him turned into 6 months.
Yeah.
And what I knew was, I knew that I didn't move to LA to like sit in somebody's office and answer phones.
Yeah.
And so right at that same time, that's when I saw that comedy show, and I was like rewriting people's material.
Sure. Yeah.
And so I remember Googling, I lived in North Hollywood at the time.
Yeah.
I remember Googling open mics near me.
Yeah.
And it was this hookah lounge.
Yeah.
And I remember it said first come for, you know, like 5 minutes, you got to buy something, like you got to buy like a coffee or something.
Yeah.
You got to buy $5 worth of something, a $5 minimum, and you get 5 minutes. Yeah.
Wow.
And you sign up, first 20 people to sign up get to go up. And I remember leaving work that day. I remember saying, you know, I'm putting in my 2 weeks notice.
Yeah.
Leaving work that day. Going to the open mic, and I needed it to be close to my house because I didn't think it was going to be good.
Yeah.
I was like, I need to just do this, feel how it feels, and then when it's bad, like I'll just go home. Nobody will ever know this happened.
Right. Yeah.
I told one friend.
It's anonymous.
Yeah. I told one friend.
Yeah.
I wrote down what I thought was material.
Yeah.
And it all started, I remember the first thing was with my family. I always started with my family.
Yeah.
And they laughed. I mean, to the point where people who were outside smoking hookah, they came in. And this is just in, I didn't even do the whole 5 minutes.
Yeah.
This was like, I'm like 3.5, 4 minutes in, and they're enjoying, you know, open mics are freaking tough.
They're weird. Don't, they're not there
weird.
For that.
People are not there for that.
Yeah.
Comedians are like, I want to get up there, try my shit out.
Yeah, there's 20 comics
and
three people who didn't know there was a comedy show.
Exactly. And they're like, what the fuck? I'm, you know, and so and it's going well. So I stop. I'm like, oh my God, you guys are laughing. And they're like, yeah, keep going. And I was like, no, I'm going to stop while I'm ahead. And I get off stage, and my friend, right when I walk out the door, my friend walks, the one friend who I told, she's like just arriving.
Yeah.
And I'm like, she's like, how was it? I was like, I think I'm going to do comedy. And she was like, girl, I told you you were funny. I'm like, what? She was like, Zaynab, you're funny. And I was like, okay. I said, I think I can be good at this.
Yeah.
And then, so here's like another sidebar. And me like becoming friends with Ian.
Yeah.
I remember that day, I remembered something that Ian told me one day when I was talking to him, which was one day I called Ian and he's like, I'm like, hey, Ian, what you doing? And he's like, oh, I just finished doing some spots.
Yeah.
And I'm still like a young girl hungry. Yeah. Right. So I'm calling Ian like, can we go get some food? That was my goal. Yeah. Right. And so he was like, I'm just finished some spots. And I was like, oh, okay. I was going to see if you wanted to go get something to eat. And he's like, no, I'll go get food with you. He was like, but just let me call you back. Cause I'm like I'm recalling my set. And I was like, what do you mean? And he was like, oh, you know, when I'm done, like I either like listen to what I recorded, or if I didn't record it, I have to like go over it in my head while it's fresh.
Yeah.
In that moment, he said that to me. I'm like, well, call me back when you're ready to eat. Right.
Yeah.
But now, 2.5 years later or whatever, when I did that open mic, I don't know why that clicked to me.
Yeah.
So I recorded the set that I did.
Yeah.
And so then the next day, I listened to that set. I rewrote it, and I went to another open mic.
Yeah.
And then I never stopped doing that.
Yeah. That was it.
I didn't start getting into... I did Last Comic Standing.
You weren't getting into clubs before Last Comic Standing? You were doing mics?
I was doing mics. And I remember...
Huh. That's a rare thing.
Yeah. I remember...
That you actually, like, you know, that's the way it should be.
Yeah.
Like a real talent show.
Yeah.
Like not some established has-been or something.
Yeah. I remember... So when I decided... Oh shoot! This is what I'm gonna. I do believe, Mark, that I could be good at a lot of things.
Yeah.
Am good at a lot of things, but and I'm not fearful of stuff. You know what I'm saying? I think the first thing is like you got to get past the fear, right? The one thing I know I'll never be good at is singing. Like that's just not something that I can do.
Okay.
Right. Tone deaf everything. Yeah. Right. So, but aside from that, I'm like,
now I want to hear you try.
but do I believe I could write a song? Sure.
Okay.
You know?
Yeah.
So, there's songwriters listening to this like.
Oh, boy. Yeah, please. Yeah.
But, so what I did was the moment, I didn't feel like I had like a true, I didn't really know much about, as much as I came to comedy shows out here, I didn't really know much about the comedy scene out here.
Yeah.
I had a stronger connection with the comedy scene in New York.
Sure, because you knew those guys.
Yeah, so what I did was I'm from New York.
Yeah.
And my family is in New York.
Yeah.
So I would fly back to New York.
Yeah.
And I remember telling Keith Robinson, I remember saying, I started doing comedy, but I need to get spots.
Yeah.
And he was like, okay, come to New York. And when I went to New York, I did the same thing. I just did open mics. I didn't show up at comedy clubs trying to get on. I just looked for every single open mic, you know?
So you moved back?
No.
I
would just book in like, you know, it's like
I live. Family
yeah,
and stuff.
So it's like, oh, I'm going to stay here for a month.
Right.
And I'm just going to do as many open mics as I can in New York.
Yeah.
And then Keith says, meet me at Stand Up New York.
Yeah.
You're going to do the check spot.
Oh.
I don't even know what that means.
Was he hosting?
No.
Okay.
But he knew he had enough leverage to say, put her on.
Yeah, yeah. When they're paying.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I went up and did the check spot, and I got off stage. And of course, I was nervous and everything, but I got off stage, and Keith says, you got something. he didn't even want to say it. He did. I mean, you know, he didn't want to give it to me. He said, you got something, right?
He was checking.
And he said, keep working. How I got into clubs has always been very like, you know. So Keith is doing a show in LA with Kevin Hart.
Yeah.
They were doing a showcase at the Improv. And Keith says, come down, I want you to do this set on Kevin's show.
Yeah.
You're gonna be one of the opening comedians. I go down, I got my 5 minutes ready, right?
Yeah.
Dave Becky is in the audience, I got my 5 minutes ready.
Yeah.
And nothing happens from that. I do a good job. Like, people think that I'm funny.
Is Dave your guy?
No, he's not. But the host was working with Wanda Sykes.
Yeah.
She had a show.
Yeah.
And he said, Wanda has to see you. That's what he said to me.
Yeah.
And I'm like, you know, people tell you everything. I don't think anything of it. I never hear from Wanda.
Yeah.
Then, like, a few months later, he emails me. That guy, I gave him my email. He emails me and he said, I just wanted you to know that I kept my word. I thought that you were great. I think that you'll have an awesome career in this. And I just wanted to send you the email that I sent to Wanda.
Okay.
And so he sends me this whole thing, right? Shortly after, he said, but the show, you know, I didn't realize that the show was ending.
Oh.
So I was too late to get you in, right? Shortly after that, Wanda Sykes is producing Last Comic Standing. So they call me in for an audition.
Yeah.
I'm not passed at any clubs. I'm open micing.
Yeah.
But I mean, diligently.
You got some time.
Yeah.
20 minutes.
Yeah. But I had about 12.
12.
Yeah. I had probably like unworked 30 minutes.
Yeah.
But like confident, I know this will do 12 to 14 minutes.
Yeah, yeah.
You know? Because it's like open mics, you're doing 5 minute sets.
Yeah, you know? Yeah.
And I auditioned for Last Comic Standing.
Yeah.
And I remember, you know, it's just like four executives in a room. They got a bunch of files.
Was Wanda there too?
I saw, as soon as I got on stage, she snuck in.
Yeah.
And I saw her sneak in. And I turned it, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
When I saw her sneak in, I was like, oh, she's coming to check me out.
Yeah. Let's go.
Let's go. And I freaking went.
Yeah.
And then I had a call back. And I remember when I got Last Comic Standing, I remember that's how Jimmy started taking me on the road. That was because we were on the same season of Last Comic Standing.
Oh,
and on our taping, they don't air it like this, but that first night that we like got passed to the next round, to the semifinals, I went on the 24th. I was the 24th comedian to go on it after being there for 7 hours.
Oh, my God.
The audience had been there for about 4 or 5 hours. I was the 24th comedian, and Jimmy was the 25th, but we killed it. And so after that, after the Last Comic Standing, you know, he was like, I need a feature. Because he was able to tour off of it. Like,
sure.
You know, and he's like, I need a feature. You want a feature? And I'm like, sure. And I was so recognizable from Last Comic Standing because I was this tall, thin, had a shaved head. Like, people used to think that I won that season just because aesthetically I was who they remember.
Well, what'd you come in?
I was a semifinalist. I was on for like two. I got a little bit. I told you I had 12 minutes.
Yeah.
I did my first 5 minutes, then I did my second 5 minutes, and then I was gone.
Yeah. but it got you recognition.
It got me recognition.
So you went out with Jimmy, and that's where you learned how to put the set together.
That's where I learned how to put the set together. And then I think the thing that opened a lot of... So then right after that, I was auditioning for JFL.
Yeah.
And I got New
Faces. New Faces, yeah. When it meant something, what year was that?
2014.
So you could still be kind of unknown.
Mm-hmm.
So it meant something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And also Keith... Again, he was taping his special.
Yeah.
This was the first club I got passed at as a regular, which is probably one of the most sought after clubs, right?
What, the Cellar?
The Cellar.
Yeah.
I was opening for him for his Comedy Central taping. And the next, I did, you know, well, I remember Kevin saying, this is yes, but, you know, just joking, like roasting him. And the next day we were like sitting, like we were maybe having lunch or something. And he was like, I'm going to, you know, I'm going to get you an audition for The Cellar.
Yeah.
He said, so do your
best. Esty?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he texts Esty, like, can she get an audition? She said, I saw her last night. She's passed.
That was easy.
And
thank God.
Yeah.
And so you started working there?
And I started working The Cellar. So I went back to New York so much. As much as I lived in LA, I went back to New York. Because once you get past at The Cellar, then it's like you could work at every other club in New York.
Yeah.
You know? And so that's where I got my spots. I wasn't really a part of the LA stand-up.
Because I don't remember seeing you.
Yeah. I wasn't really a part of it.
Until just after COVID.
Yeah. Yeah. until I, I would just go back to New York. And that's where I would, even if I had something here, like something be like, oh, you're about to tape something or you have a showcase, I would book a trip to New York.
So that was your place?
Yeah.
And that's where everyone knew you?
Yeah, and that's why people are like, aren't you a new, oh, when did you move out here? And I'm like, I lived here the whole time.
Oh, that's interesting. Mm-hmm. So now, what is this show you're on? When you leaving, you're going to Montreal, but when don't you have to start shooting again? Something?
Yeah, I'm on Upload.
Third season?
Yeah, we're shooting the third season. We go back to Vancouver to shoot in a month.
You like Vancouver?
I love Vancouver.
Me too. I love it. I want to live there.
Do you?
Kinda.
Really? Yeah. Like that part of Canada or Canada generally,
Well, I don't know. It'd be Toronto or Vancouver, but I like the way Vancouver looks, but I know and feels, but I know it's rainy there a lot.
But I mean, Toronto has like brutal winters.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I was there right before the pandemic. It was one of my last, I went and did like a live podcast or something, podcast show, and it was brutal. I love that city. Good food. I love it. Mm-hmm. It's like Canada's New York, you know?
Yeah.
But
too cold. Yeah, it's rough.
It's
huh?
like you in Chicago in a winter.
No kidding. Yeah. So you're going to go up to Montreal and do 2 weeks up there?
Two and a half,
just headlining?
I'm so particular about taping material.
What do you mean? You're afraid to burn it?
I'm not afraid to burn it.
You just want to burn it in the right place.
Yeah, I like to burn it in the right place. I like things to be, you know. So
I'm sitting here trying to figure out.
What can I repurpose?
What are these 17 minutes don't matter?
Yeah, exactly.
It's not so much don't matter, but like I know that like I'm going to tape my HBO special in December. Mm-hmm. So I know there's shit in there that's not going to be, December is too, it's too long.
Yeah, yeah.
So I can do it now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I also recognize how bad, I didn't know this at first, but now I know how valuable our material is. It's literal IP coming out of our mouth.
Mm.
And I don't always think that people show how valuable our, and I think that I used to be at a place where you just want to do everything and you want to do so much.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's so like a gala show, that sounds good. That's a nice thing. That's always exciting at JFL. Like I remember when I was the new face and the people who was doing galas, I'm like, I can't wait to be invited to do a gala. But now I do not look at it like that. I look at it truly like, what do I gain from this? And what am I giving up for this? And is it equal? And if it's not, it doesn't appeal to me in the same way.
I get it, you know. But there's also this weird thing we have in our heads that I'll churn through hours and hours. I don't know how it happens, but it happens. I'm running through hour and a half, 2 hours now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, of stuff that's pretty strong.
Mm-hmm.
Some of it's better than others. And there's this idea we have in our head that, you know, if we put it on TV in any way, that is dead.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I don't know if that's all true. Because for me, like, there were decades where people didn't know who the fuck I was.
Yeah.
I've got 4 or 5 CDs worth of shit and maybe 2 specials where people didn't really know who I was. So, yeah, I'm still a discoverable thing. You know, I'm not an arena guy. You know, I'm a, 800 to 1,200 seat guy, maybe 2,000 in some cities. Mm-hmm. But my point is, it's like, it's sort of sad that we have this idea that once you put it out there, it's done, that you can't tour on it.
So you're absolutely right. And that is not, but that's not like where I'm coming from.
Hmm.
So I'm working on a special as well, right?
Right.
And so that means when I get up on stage, I try to be very intentional. So a lot of the work that I'm doing is towards the material that I plan on doing on the special.
When are you going to shoot it?
To be determined.
Mm. Oh, is it a self-produced thing?
No.
Oh, okay.
No.
You just don't know yet?
Yeah.
Okay.
But what I don't want to do, see, I could go up on a show and work stuff out,
sure.
But I do not like to work stuff out where people are taping it.
No, I get it.
Because then they put, I have a joke like that that I did at a gala show at JFL, and I watch that, I watch it in its infancy, and I'm like, oh yeah, this is
better
much
joke.
Better now, but
sure.
But what's cemented, what they're playing, what they're posting, what they keep using, because contractually they can, is this
half done.
Yeah, half done version.
I get it. No one's watching it. No one's watching it.
You're right. Right.
But I get it. You know, like I used to do that on Conan all the time because he'd have me on. They used to give me that show when people would not show up.
Mm-hmm.
So on day before,
yeah.
Do you got anything? I'd always do panel because I could do half-baked jokes.
Yeah.
There's like hours of me doing Conan O'Brien sets of jokes that got much better and I used other places because no one was watching.
Yeah.
And they just became better jokes. But I get it. But we have our own sort of, we're hard on ourselves like that because there's part of you probably, knowing that's out there, you're like, I can't do that joke in any form. You know, on TV again anyways, or no?
Sometimes, yeah.
Mm.
But if it's like, I don't know, like the stuff that's like special to me,
yeah.
It's like that's the stuff that I'm trying to figure out and it's causing me frustration. Some nights it's really fun, but some nights it's like unlocking like what this joke is really about or what I'm trying to say and then what's funny about, you know what I'm saying? Like
yeah.
In a funny way. That's really, that is what's occupying my mind and my spirit right now. And so I don't, Maybe I need to just like let go and not take it too. But I'm just a really intentional person.
No, you're working on an hour, and you
yeah,
want and you
so
want it to have.
I don't need the nuisance
yeah,
of like trying to figure out
5 minutes.
A 7 minute
sure,
set
yeah.
for a gala.
I'm right there. I got this fucking gig 2 years ago. 2 years ago. And now I'm working on an hour, and I'm like, oh, my God. I'm going to fucking do 10 minutes and then a 7 minutes?
Yeah, but I'm most looking forward to the 2 nights where I get to just run my hour. At
yeah,
JFL.
Me too.
That's
I'm gonna
what
do
I'm
that.
Looking forward
yeah.
to.
I'm going
to
do
know?
That too. Yeah, of course.
So.
Because you're working it out.
And if anybody records, I'm going to freaking.
I must have nice fans. No one ever fucking records me.
Really?
Yeah.
So wait, even when you, how is that, even being on TV, like people don't show up and just record you?
No, it's weird. I never see anything. I never like, and put it on YouTube or something?
No, that's the strange thing about when people record.
What?
I'm like, I ask people sometimes when I watch them record other comedians, I'm like, I just watched you record for, are you going to rewatch this? Or do you send it to your friends? Do you post? They're like, oh no, I'll never post this. And I'm like, so what do you do with it? Like,
yeah.
Like we don't have that much phone space on our phones, and they're like, I don't know. It's just like I think it's funny. I like it, so I just record it.
Yeah, so they were there.
Yeah, but they don't show anybody.
Yeah, I don't know what it is. But I don't see it. Most of my audience are grownups.
I was gonna say I didn't want to be. I was gonna say, do you have an older audience?
Yeah,
yeah.
I do now. Thank God.
They're not pulling out camera phones, but the
not
young
too
kids.
Much. Yeah.
The young kids, they watch you through the camera.
I know.
Lens.
I know. It's weird. But I guess that's the way it is.
And also, you know, people record because in the hopes that something happens.
And then they can.
And they get it. Yeah. They've documented the moment. Like, you don't know if something is going to happen.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Like when someone tackles you.
So someone tackles you.
Or you do some crowd
yeah,
work.
Yeah, or you say something wrong.
I always record my sets. I should record them on video. But I'm not on TikTok and shit. So, like, I drew the line, I guess, at Instagram. But because I know that a lot of people are doing crowd work intentionally for Instagram pieces,
yeah,
to draw people to the shows,
yeah.
And I thought about it. I'm like, who am I? Do I want those people at my shows?
Well, if you want to do stadiums,
I don't. I'm good. I'm good with theaters. I'm going to Vegas to do a club because I don't want to do casinos.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, it's not my, I'm not out to conquer the world.
I do like an intimate crowd.
No, it's the best.
Yeah, I do like it.
Because then you can really get into that. What are like what you were saying before? What am I trying to say with
yeah.
this stuff? What you know? What's funny about this stuff? What risks can I take?
Yeah,
here?
It's just a different exchange of energy.
No shit.
It's yeah. It's I love intimacy in that way.
Well, it's good talking to you.
It was great talking to you, Mark.
I guess so.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for doing it. I'll see you in Canada.
I'll see you in Canada.
Okay, that was wild. The big reveal of the horrible accident and her attitude around it and how she's framed it in her life. You can go to ZainabJohnson.com for her stand-up dates. And also, if you could, just hang out a minute, please. Thank you. Thank you. Hang on. Just please hold. So I've been going a little crazy because I have Neil Gaiman on Monday, and I've got to talk to him. And there was a brief window in my life where Sandman and Hellblazer were very important to me. I don't know why. I think I was still a little out of my mind. I think I felt like you know, that the John Constantine story was sort of like my future. I was having problems with reality. I think it was probably somewhere in the, yeah, it had to have been the sort of mid to late 80s, like 87-ish, when I went through this comic book stuff. I think it was the beginning of Hellblazer, and then Sandman came later, and it was sort of like, you know, it was speaking to a part of me as someone who is not a fantasy nerd that, you know, that somehow resonated with my reality. That's the sad truth. I don't know if I bring that up with Gaiman. I guess we'll all find out. But he's on Monday. I'm in Montreal this weekend at Just for Laughs. My solo shows are sold out, but my gala is on Saturday night. Then next week, I'll be in Columbus, Ohio at the Southern Theater on August 4th, Indianapolis, Indiana. I'm at the Old National Center on August 5th, Louisville, Kentucky at the Baumhard Theater, August 6th, which I hope is not a prophecy. All those dates I'll be doing with Lara Bites. Then I'm back at Dynasty Typewriter in L.A. on August 14th, and then Lincoln, Nebraska at the Rococo Theater on August 18th, Des Moines, Iowa at the Hoyt Sherman Place on August 19th, and Iowa City, Iowa at the Englert Theater on August 20th, all with Lara Bites, the very funny Lara Bites. Lara. In September, I'm in Tucson, Arizona, Phoenix, Arizona, Boulder, Colorado, and Toronto, Ontario, Canada. In October, I'm in London, England, and Dublin, Ireland. Go to WTFpod.com/tour for all dates and ticket info. Okay, now here's some slide guitar. Sloppy slide on an old K guitar tuned to an open D. I'll just give it a try. I'm giving it a try.
Let's see. Monkey, LaFonda, Cat Angels Everywhere.